RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our Friday political panel. I look forward to this every Friday, and I want to welcome on to our panel this morning a new addition. He spent over 25 years in public relations and political lobbying after a career in journalism, Glenn Inwood. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on, mate.
Great to have you with us, and we will tap your superior knowledge of all things through the next time, almost an hour.
God help us.
Annie O'Brien, thanks for coming back, Annie.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. And Marty Gibson in the panelled room still.
As always. Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm good. Great to have you folk on board this morning. Boy, it's sort of hard to know where to start. It's been quite a week. Glenn, I think we'll start with you because you're close to the scene, the political scene. Trans athletes debacle. Has a coalition promise been broken here, or are we all just jumping up and down for no reason? What do you reckon?
Well, I think what we saw was the mainstream media come out and do an article which basically said that the promise that sporting bodies, publicly funded sporting bodies, would be held to account in respect of allowing men and boys to self-identify and play in women's sports, was the article was saying that they were backtracking on that, the government was going to U-turn on that. And I think as it emerged over sort of a period of 48 hours, it does appear to be that it was either a very active bureaucrat who put something out or whatever. But either way, this is a very important policy for New Zealand First. It was one of the most widely supported policies during the 2023 election, and it is well written into the coalition agreement. So for them to come out, I think, and backtrack on that would have been a very big mistake for New Zealand First. But it does appear now that Winston Peters has unequivocally made the statement that that is not going to happen, that he'll be having words with Chris Bishop about that and talking to them about that policy. And also he expected to see Raylene Castle from Sports New Zealand at the rugby this weekend, so maybe there might be a few words there, a clarification of the government policy on that. So it doesn't look like that's changing at all.
Okay, Annie?
Oh, you know, I've got opinions on this stuff.
No, really?
They get me in trouble frequently. Look, I mean, agreeing with what Glenn's just said there, it does seem like there was a bit of a media beat up. They took an inch and ran a mile. However, it's an issue that, like many other matters that are being dealt with right now, the advice coming from public servants and from officials from various bodies is contradicting not only what the government has stated it's going to do, but the will of the people who voted for them. And so this is just another example where I think the government needs to look beyond the media, beyond the Raylene Castles and the public servants, and look at the polling that says most New Zealanders really like this policy. Most New Zealanders think that blokes shouldn't be able to just say, I'm a lady today, I'm going to play in this sports team.
Loos.
Or any of the above. I think, particularly Chris Bishop and Nicola Willis, we know that they are on the more liberal end of the National Party, and they need to really stop listening to the lanyard-wearing bougie elites.
Lanyard-tugging.
With their luxury beliefs and pronouns and bio, they need to trust that on the other side of the media, there are just ordinary Kiwis going, this is common sense, can we just get on with it? And as for Raylene Castle, she needs to stop calling herself a feminist. She's a fake. She has a lot to say about disparities and the challenges of female sport, but then she is quite happy to open the door and hold a welcoming party for blokes who want to colonise women's sport. So she can shush until she's going to, put some action behind those words.
Marty, do you think there's some kind of undermining going on of this government? And Glenn, you want to speak to this too, I would imagine.
By some kind of, you could say, extensive and widespread. And it's always about yeah, there seems to be a fairly large proportion of public servants who are quite opposed to the present coalition. And, yeah, they often leak things which are going to be damaging to them via an already oppositional media. And one of the things I always talk about with the when the trans issue comes up is that fascinating graph that was done of the number of times transgenderism was mentioned, and it just takes off like a rocket about 2012, which was about when the left, well, the more government, less freedom side of politics started with Occupy Wall Street, and the right was dealing with the Tea Party. Now, the people who print the money that's going to see government debt going up, and I saw Matthew Hooton wrote an article. He was estimating, saying that if everything goes to plan, Willis will take gross debt above 48% of GDP by 2028. That's what they don't want us talking about. And they're much more comfortable with us talking about men with autogynephilia. You know,
wanting like look to that way, not this way.
Yeah, I'm a lady. You know, good on them, but you know, there's more important things.
Spectacular distraction, though. Spectacular.
Yeah.
And I think it's symptomatic of the bureaucracy at the moment, who after 6 years of having a, basically a rule over the Labour Party, I think they're finding it difficult to realise that, quite frankly, maybe they're not the boss anymore. Maybe they don't aren't the ones who are just going to come out with policies and whatever, and without running it past the Parliament first. And I think we're going to start seeing a bit of that pushback coming in with this government. Well, I certainly would hope that.
Do you think, though, Glenn, that the National Party and the... Because I've spoken to David Seymour, haven't spoken to Christopher Luxon. He was quite comfortable with the, you know, the library drag queen stuff before the election when I spoke to him. Seemed quite comfortable with that, you know. It's like Barry Humphries did it. No. I wonder if there's kind of like a bit of a split on how...
Well, you can go back to before the election where Luxon said that anyone who wanted to talk about this as an election issue was on another planet.
Mm.
You know, then you can see then why it might be being walked back. They don't want to punch that tar baby.
All right. Anything more to say about that?
Well, I think it's still a live issue. I don't think it's been resolved completely just yet. You've still seen Chris Bishop signing letters from his officials to say that we, you know, he's going to take a watching brief on this issue. And I still think that New Zealand First has a clause in that coalition agreement that they will want honoured. And ACT has, I'm not sure if ACT has it, and I don't remember it. I could be wrong. New Zealand First will have to make sure that that coalition clause, that agreement, is upheld to the greatest extent.
Yesterday I had Winston on, and I had the Sport NZ site open, and I noticed the most prominent graphic on their homepage was stats on how many transgender people were comfortable with being in sport, and, you know, there are a few other things. It was the most prominent, colourful graphic on the page. It was nothing about other people in sport. It was that. So, just saying.
Yeah, I mean, the New Zealand Rugby Union said that given the barriers to sport and level of discrimination faced by sex and gender diverse people, New Zealand Rugby considers it important that such people participating in lower levels of the game do not face further discriminations when these have not yet been justified. It's only going to take one or two tackles by a large man identifying as a woman in a woman's rugby game to justify such a ban. And
yeah, they're not sacrificing their own daughter's health, their own daughter's opportunities, scholarships, enjoyment. It's other people's daughters who will be the experiment until it gets proven, you know?
Annie, just saying, whenever I see you comment on X or anything in this area, talk about incomings, big time, on both sides, you get quite a bit of, flack.
Oh, I do. But it's been 10 years now. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
It's been 10 years of saying there are two sexes, humans can't change sex, ladies don't have penises, men can't be lesbians, like stuff that we knew, you know. And it's amazing how, of all the things I say, and I have lots of opinions on lots of matters, but of all the things I say, this is still the thing that makes people the angriest on a certain side of politics.
I want to ask Glenn quickly, with your knowledge of New Zealand First, just sort of riffing off what we've just been talking about, you know, there's other things. Maybe they're not keeping a tight enough sort of hand on the wheel or whatever, or on whatever. You know, there was nothing said about the World Health Assembly, the IHRs. We don't know what's happening with this frickin' inquiry. No one's saying anything. The Vice Director General, whatever his title is, of Health in New Zealand was in Geneva fawning over it, saying all these lovely words. How come he gets to speak and represent us like that? You want to hear politicians talking about it, specifically NZ First, because this is what they campaigned on. What's going on there, do you think?
Yeah, well, you certainly do. And it's very opaque at the moment, Paul, isn't it? We certainly need some clarity around what is the government going to do with those IHRs. They do appear to have been pushed through at the WHO level. We've got our former Director General of Health up there serving as the chair of that committee, Ashley Bloomfield. And it doesn't appear to be enough support around that cabinet table for stopping that. That is a real concern. It was a very strong policy for New Zealand First, and they do need to you know show where their support is on that and what their position is a lot clearer.
Are they too busy?
Could be too busy. Could be that there are only three votes around a cabinet table of 20.
Yeah, but we could say we could walk away too. That's what Trump always said. Make sure they know you could walk away.
You could walk away, but then the consequences of that are the latest poll that I saw out of Roy Morgan was that your Labour, Green and Party Māori coalition is pushing up to 45%. Now, there is a chance you might lose if you do walk away from that coalition.
Okay. Marty, anything to say before we move on?
As I said, it's what they'd rather us be talking about the transgender stuff than the pharmaceutical companies and the Communist Chinese Party taking control of our health system.
Well, maybe we should get off it pronto then. All right.
Well, the media, the wider media other than RCR are doing New Zealand a disservice by favouring those topics over this one as well.
Jacinda Ardern to lead Global Fellowship of Progressive, as Lindsay said, get the bath bucket out. Progressive leaders. Oh my golly, who wants to start this one?
It's a good bit of gaslighting, isn't it? Because it's that classic, you know, that talk of kindness stimulates rage, and then it looks like kindness is needed. It makes those who oppose her look like big meanies and brings out the low testosterone white knights to defend her. it is a tactic that's loved by narcissists to do something awful and then play the victim. Why are you getting so mad? I can't go out without protection because of all this misogyny. You know, it's.
I'm just trying to be kind.
Yeah, the thing that really interests me about this is the devouring mother archetype. I think that's what we're dealing with here. You know, the woman who selfishly loves her children, protecting them in inverted commas from the real world to such an extent that they become permanent infants. I think you could pull that string and a lot of it makes sense. The nanny state that seeks to protect citizens by sheltering them from reality, suppress free speech in the name of political correctness. It's all this pathologic kind of kindness.
Look who she's hanging out with, though, in this.
Yeah, yeah, she didn't go and work at a food bank, did she?
Fish
she went
chip
straight
shop.
And hung out with Prince Harry.
Look, at least it wasn't Atlas. It was only Soros. So there you go.
You know, it's the same with the Green Party. Their sanctimony over, you know, I can't believe you don't want to save the planet, you know. Well, I just want to do it another way.
I want to save the planet from you.
Yeah.
It's the same mentality, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's short-term versus long-term kindness. The kindest thing you can do for a meth addict in the short term is give them some methamphetamine. And the kindest thing you can do in the long term is call the cops sometimes. So you can, and they've been so good with words, haven't they? I was reading, there was an article tucked away on page 7 of Friday's Herald about National's boot camps. And the,
back on track.
Yeah, this reluctantly reported story about them, and they're actually pretty good. You know, the kids aren't held for long. They're given one-on-one mentorship with one social worker for them and their whānau. You know, it all sounds pretty good, but it hasn't really made the news. They should have called it the, well, you know.
I look at some of the I look at some of the comments regarding the story we're talking about, and there's still people right off the planet on this, like, oh, she's so wonderful. Please come back. I mean, how do we explain that?
It's she reminds me of me, and she had a baby.
I mean, I viewed this very, very cynically, and like you say, it felt like gaslighting. And I think it's fair to say that looking at the state of our health, education, cost of living stats, like in data and in fact, we can say that the country is in worse shape than when she got it. And so is it better to be kind and ruin the country or be a bit more stern and less cuddly?
She wasn't being kind, Annie. There was
I'm being charitable. I mean, the thing is, you can kind of, you know, she smiled and spoke in soft tones while she kept New Zealand citizens out of the country in the middle of an international crisis. So it was a superficial veneer that she wore while she behaved like some of the most ruthless leaders that have, you know, been around ever. But I do think that there's this kind of infant-like desire by some people to have a mother in charge, like you know, like you said, that devouring mother who will coddle them rather than having rather than having a capable but perhaps less, I don't know, relatable person leading the show who delivers a stable economy and sharpens up the public service and does all the, you know, boring bits that we need. It all just feels quite nauseatingly fake. But that is what a lot of people would assess Jacinda to be. And I mean, I don't think that this will affect us in the slightest because she'll just have wealthy leaders from other countries paying lots of money to go and, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But on the psyche of this country, it's just a bit of a kick while we're still struggling to get back on our feet. You know, it's like
ideology will do that, and she will has pushed an ideology for the last 6 years from stopping all exploration of oil and gas in New Zealand. Yeah. All the way through to pretending she can resolve child poverty by being kind. And she has, you are quite right, Annie and Marty, she has left New Zealand in the worst possible shape any leader ever could have. And she is now going out and wreaking that you know, on the rest of the world. And yes, they are lapping it up. Only to an extent. And we have seen in the last couple of weeks the change in the EU, who have decided that they're going to start pushing back against this. And hopefully we can see that happen. I mean, to me, I mean, my version of Jacinda being kind is unrepeatable on this station.
Ooh, unrepeatable. Okay, but she still is perceived as kind of representing us, and I'm not happy with that, I've got to say.
I mean, you know, probably Canadians fear the same about Trudeau. And
I feel more sorry for them.
Well, they do. They do. And he's had the lowest statistics ever of a Canadian leader now. It came out just today.
Imagine the hide you have to hang in there and stay out in the public. And you can hear it in how she was describing the project. It's create a network of like-minded political leaders who use pragmatic idealism, speak to people with hope and optimism rather than fear or blame, and want to unite rather than divide as we look to solve the challenge. You can just imagine a picture of the world suckling at her teat.
Please stop.
The unite rather than divide is what winds me up the most, I think, because of the divisions she sowed especially in throughout COVID, but also with the enabling of some of the race conversations we're now having, we're getting into a very toxic place socially in this country, and I do place a lot of that at her feet. And so for her to kind of snidely comment as if, you know, look at them over there, they're dividing and I was a uniter. I think
she's saying that's what it is, to two-tier society. Yeah, that's what it is. Yep. I mean, it's on tape.
Well, she's also saying that she's going to humanize the leadership and just be, I just want to be useful. And again, she's a WEF young leader, young global leader, and they're all about ending humanity by bringing in a post-humanist world.
So it's total gaslighting is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you've always got to look upstream from her because, you know, the people who are doing this, it's useful for them to have narcissistic, relatable.
What do you think it would have been like working under her, you know?
I've heard some stories.
Glenn, what do you reckon it would have been like for some of her colleagues? Because they must have been thinking, oh, my God, every time.
I imagine it would have been very hard for many of those low backbencher MPs in the Labour Party to do anything that was against what Chris, Megan, Grant, Jacinda and that top tier were doing. I think they would have been stamped on very quickly. In fact, I've spoken to a few of the Labour Party backbenchers, a couple of them, and that was the message that they were delivering to.
Right.
And those memoranda that came out were, we're far ahead enough in the polls that we don't have to explain. Instead, we can dismiss.
Mm. You got some stories, Annie?
Yeah, come on.
it's the type of thing that's never, you know, if it was a prime minister or a minister now and there were stories of them screaming at officials and stuff, it would be in the newspaper without anything to corroborate it, but we never had that reporting at the time. But
yeah, but there was a bit of that. All right, someone mentioned race, I think it was you, Annie, and we are aware now of Maria Menor Kapa Kingi of the Māori Party, Te Pāti Māori, saying that Māori children are not New Zealanders. That's going next level, isn't it?
It breaks my heart, to be honest. This party is hacking away at the social fabric of this country, and that they are attempting to drive huge wedges. I think I said today on Twitter or X, whatever you call it, you know, nationhood is what brings us together. In New Zealand, we have people from so many different cultures, races, you know, speaking 200 languages and practicing various religions. We all identify with those different parts of ourselves to varying degrees, and it's the overarching unifying thing is that we're New Zealanders, that this is the nation that we live in, and it's what binds our society. It's what gives legitimacy to our political and legal systems, is that this is the country we live in. We take part in democracy here, and despite all of our vast differences, this is the umbrella we all sit under. It's really concerning that this narrative is being really fed by the Māori Party, and especially they seem to be using Maria Menor Kapa Kingi as the kind of lightning rod to go and say all this stuff. But it looks to me as if it is just further attempts to fracture the connections between Māori New Zealanders and other New Zealanders, and also within Māori, because it's fracturing them from the other parts of themselves, and there are other parts of their heritage. It's really extremist rhetoric. It bugs me big time that, you know, the legacy.
Isn't it dangerous? Here, it's actually dangerous, isn't it? Because the message, excuse me, to Māori youth is you're not one of them.
Yeah, well, in case you've forgotten this. Sorry, I was just going to say, she's the one who said that the government will not waver in its mission to exterminate Māori. So, that is, and as you say, Annie, that is dangerous to tell young, disaffected people. Yep. That sort
separate
of thing.
Them so they are separated in their thinking, and therefore anything can them. Go, right?
It's an ethno-nationalist movement, though.
And
the media just doesn't have the stones to call it out for what it is.
I get so cross that the legacy media has not reported on this. There is, I don't know if it is a conscious editorial decision.
It's got to be.
They
Let's
do
call
not
it.
Report on Te Pāti Māori when they make these outrageous claims. And so people should know any political party, they should be seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? If people just see, oh, the Māori Party, they're standing up for Māori, okay, yep, that's cool. But they're not seeing those extreme elements. They're not aware of the full picture. And I really think that this is a radicalizing movement. And if we don't find a way to coherently provide an alternative narrative, which is that we are better as a country, as all New Zealanders, with different backgrounds and different beliefs and blah, 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 we're going down a very ugly path. And we cannot present that coherent alternative narrative while the legacy media is telling everyone that narrative is racist and that it is the right thing to devolve into an ethno state and have a separate parliament and have a, you know, separate everything. So this really concerns me. And I think Karen Shaw did a fantastic job of remaining calm and stating her position. And I do think that if New Zealanders saw that clip, they would largely think, that lady there, I'm with her. She really stayed calm and articulated that actually for her, every child in New Zealand, regardless of background, deserves safety, health, well-being, you know, end of story.
Yeah, but the argument's not about that, is it? The argument's about trying to force a division. So you've got people on your side. Glenn, what do you make of it?
Well, this whole race issue has really started kicking off from, what, a couple of days after the coalition government was sworn in late November, and so it took three days for Māori Party to do a large protest up to Parliament. You know, they've been pouring fuel on this racial thing for weeks now, and I agree everything with what Annie and Marty have just have said. The media do need to hold them to account. They do need to pull them up and get them to fully justify a lot of what they're saying, because it can't be justified. I don't even know what it means when somebody says Māori children aren't New Zealanders. What I have no idea what that phrase actually stands for. You know, being part Māori myself, you know, I'm a New Zealander first and foremost. So the Māori Party really is a very big problem at the moment. It's not the Māori Party that you saw under Tariana Turia and Peter Sharples. Just the same way as this Labour Party isn't the same Labour Party as you saw under Helen Clark or even under David Longley, a long way from David Longley's party, that's for sure. And in many ways, everything changes and everything evolves, but it's evolving in a way that's going to be separatist and it's going to divide this country very badly. And what we do need to do, I believe, is have a very serious debate on the future of the Waitangi Tribunal.
It was interesting in the House, Winston Peters quoting John Tamahiri, talking about the danger of race-based politics and contrast that with the way he talks now. And in between that, and, you know, I mean, maybe just a coincidence, he's had a trip with Christopher Hipkins to China. And you have to ask, well, whose interest is it, and whose interest is it to be constantly telling non-Māori New Zealanders, you don't belong here, you're here illegitimately, you're a settler, you're a coloniser. Sort of takes the fight out of people for their country.
Sorry, who had a trip to Japan with
John Tamahiri, with Tame Iti, who's, of course, trying to set up?
Did they go on the plane?
No.
Oh, they went previous visit, is it?
This is with Christopher.
Oh, to China. Oh, okay, I got you. Yeah, because I know Luxon's been in Japan.
When was this?
Oh, I can't remember the exact date, but it was with Christopher Hipkins, so it was in the year that he was Prime Minister.
When he was Prime Minister. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Glenn, you've got experience of Japan. We sort of seem to be a lot closer all of a sudden. What's going on there?
Look, I don't know what's going on there. I'm glad that we are, because Japan is a very good country to do business. You will find that a lot of people who have business relationships with Japanese companies, it goes very well. They're very honest. As a lot of people have said to me, now I'm on the New Zealand Taiwan Business Council as well. And a lot of people, they say, when you do business with China and you sign that contract, that's not even the start of your negotiations. You may think it is, but it's not. But if in Japan, when you sign a contract, that's it, to the letter of the law, and that will happen. And there's a lot of certainty with doing business with Japan. It's an old country for us to do have relationships with. And I know they'd like to do more business with us, but, you know, there is not too many Japanese, you know, there's not a lot of Japanese investment other than your forestry, a little bit in your fisheries, although there could be more in fishing and imports. So, no, that's good. It's very much, we need to start building more relationships like that.
Okay.
You could buy a really nice apartment over there for $100,000. And I must confess, sometimes I've pictured myself just moving to a small Japanese village and being a Zen monk.
I'm just picturing you as that right now. I think it works.
Yeah.
All right. So that's not good. What we've just been talking about, not good. Okay. Several Green members from the Green Party have been caught asking to use the private car parks belonging to Wellington retailers for a party event. This is after their cycleway has like trashed their business. We've talked to people, you know, in that area, and even one of them was kind of harangued by one of these Green MPs. So it's a bit rich, isn't it, eh? A bit rich.
Oh, honestly, the Greens are the gift that keeps giving with this stuff. Like, I get a perverse joy from political hypocrisy. Like, I just find it really entertaining. And they've delivered another perler this week. They're really good at delivering. You know, having destroyed businesses, I used to live in Newtown and was there when they were kind of trying to stop the cycleway from going ahead. And there was a concerted effort from these local businesses who are, you know, Newtown's a run-down wee place.
But we like it.
We love it, but it's not wealthy business owners, like this perception of like a wealthy business. No. These are hardworking, but quite hard up, some of them. And they're just trying to save their family business. And like, you know, this bloody cycleway has created chaos outside the hospital and removed all the bloody on-street car parks. So the Green MPs, Paul and Genta, thought they'd have a shindig to celebrate their new offices, you know, their new electorates.
Nice.
And they had the brass bollocks to ask if they could use the private off-street car parks of the businesses that they tried to destroy with their cycle.
It's shameless. It really is. It's absolute shameless stuff coming from the Greens, eh?
I know. And needless to say, the response was short and sharp, I'd say. And they did not get use of the car parks.
I mean, I hate to be the pop psychologist, but yeah, Julianne Genta's rage toward the shopkeeper who pointed to the empty $20 million a kilometre cycleway outside her shop and told her that her business was about to go under because it had taken the car parks her customers had used, you know, and then she just goes off on what can only be described as narcissistic rage. And there's nothing a narcissist hates more than having the self-image poked at by reality. And the reality is that a person in an advanced Western civilization uses the human energy output of 900 people working around the clock. So if you put a cycleway in, well, that's 899 if you don't count the amount of energy it takes to make the cycleway, the amount of efficiency lost to cars by forcing them to go slower. Yeah, it doesn't work.
It's a stupid cycleway as well. It crosses a lane in front of the hospital, and I swear they're going to kill cyclists there because as you're driving past the hospital, you've got to cross over the cycleway because they've not thought it through. It's stupid.
You want to try Thorndon Quay. Thorndon Key is just as bad. So they're having the bicycle lane go behind the bus stop. So the bus has to stop in the middle of the road lane to pick up bus, you know, passengers now.
$20 million a kilometre.
$20 million a kilometre.
It's got to be a scam, surely. Going to be a scam.
I have to say, I've actually been enjoying Shane Jones giving Chloe a thorough education in mining. So that's been another kind of highlight of hypocrisy for me the last few weeks, because I don't know if it's all the Greens or just Chloe, but she seems to think that mining is just for like fuel for cars. Like that's the only thing we use it for, is like just to get the petrol, and never mind the buses and trains that use it as well. And, you know, because she doesn't have a car and Ubers don't count. She's absolutely, you know, pure on this. And she says, we don't need mining. But I had a wee look at her Instagram, and from her cool girl Doc Martens to her DJing equipment and her LPs, you know, the cell phone that is always in her hand, all of it requires mined materials and mineral to make. Yeah.
Stephen Joyce pointed that out as well about the protests, and he said the nadir of unreality had to be the image of perennial protester Russell Norman reading his speech to the gathering from his expensive, imported, made-of-mineral smartphone.
Yeah.
I saw that, yeah.
It's even, so she's outspoken, I don't know if it's still the case, but she said she drinks oat milk, she has her oat milk lattes. Well, oat milk is very reliant on mining products because of the factories and the industrial machines that are required to mill the oats and make the oat milk.
Yep.
So it's not, she just doesn't seem to get the steps. She's like, well, I drink oat milk, so I don't have the cows. She doesn't get the process that kind of has come before that.
Yeah, 900 people on exercycles working around the clock so she can live. So she sort of, maybe gets rid of one of them for an hour and is patting herself on the back.
And those Palestinian flags, I tell you, the polyester, you know, it's all petrol byproducts and stuff.
What they also don't understand is each one of those wind turbines that are on the hills around Wellington, each one contains around 5 tons of copper.
Yeah.
A few more tons of cobalt, nickel, molybdenum, you name it.
And something like 300 tons of concrete.
Yeah, it's all got to come from somewhere, Marty, right? And yet, by the same token, these groups do not want to take polymetallic nodules from the seabed of the floor of the seafloor.
Because you know a lot, Glenn.
And use that to electrify the global economy. Well, how are you going to electrify the global economy if you're not prepared to dig some minerals up out of the ground or off the seabed?
If I hear evidence-based from Chloe Swarbrick one more time, evidence-based, oh my God, like they're just not living in reality. And it's the classic case of like, you know, the elitists with soft hands who pass judgment and like on the industries that the people in the regions and the working people, you know, can prosper with these jobs and mines. But that doesn't matter to them, because what matters more is being ideologically pure and saying I'm anti-mining. And honestly, God bless Shane Jones, because he is now I think is the first time where an alternative narrative has been presented. You know, there's been people saying the stuff we're saying right now, but Shane Jones is the first time in a long time there's been someone in Parliament, and he was gagged when he was in there last term. But he's there going, hang on a minute, and just providing that alternate narrative, which is that, you know, you talk about wanting jobs for the poor and the people in the regions. Well, imagine the work in Taranaki or down on the West Coast that these communities are going to have, where they are going to actually prosper. So instead of sending, you know, like Shane Jones says, his Māori nephews from up north over to fly in, fly out in Western Australia, where they get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, well, they could be earning that in New Zealand, and New Zealand could be prospering off that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Glenn, for you, EU elections and potential, and this is what's freaking me out at the moment, I got to say, for wider war in Europe. What do you reckon?
Oh, Well, where do you start, Paul? I mean, but, you know, in many ways, a lot of what we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes or so is also related to what's been happening in Europe. And I think what you've seen in the EU especially is a move away from that form of globalization that is about making the Western world uniform in everything from the economy to politics, even to language. The voting public are turning away towards more towards economic nationalism, civil nationalism. They're sick and tired of the Western globalists wanting to control it all. And so the EU elections, I think, can only really be viewed as a rejection of that ongoing globalization, the international citizen, the nouveau elites, those who those who think the discussions at Davos are the important way forward. And that pendulum is swinging. France, you saw it in France with Marine Le Pen's national rally beating out Macron's party. And so the only way he can stem that bleed from the Renaissance party is by calling a snap election. You've seen it in the UK. The Conservatives have been, in the latest polls, are being outstripped by Reform Party and Nigel Farage. Again, another snap election being called. These people are in real panic mode. We've all, you know, this is just this move towards a more conservative political base has come from the win of Giorgia Meloni in Italy. You've also seen the AfD in Germany get a lot of support in Spain, Portugal, and of course we are seeing it with Trump in the US. And so it's a kickback against the uni parties. And the real issue here for New Zealand, I think, is that National and ACT, and to an extent New Zealand First, need to understand that should be able to flow over through to New Zealand. And as Annie was talking about, God bless Shane Jones, that's part of that pushback here in New Zealand. It's the same sort of thing. The swing is just going to accelerate. Those parties in the US, in the EU, I think, you know, they have to figure some way out. The EU itself is the one controlling Europe, yet nationally, those parties they're not ruling in France or in Germany they are, but in France they're going to have to find another way to look for it, and you might see Farage become the new Conservative Party. So there's a real move towards that Conservative political move. Yeah.
Will that stop a war?
Well, they have issues here that we don't really have. Eh? Like they have widespread immigration that's been occurring for the last decade or 15 to 20 years, especially from Africa, and they have a war on their doorstep, and that is just sucking the money out of the EU like nothing else, and they really have their heads in the sand about that, the EU does.
And power prices going up 500% in Germany, that's probably led to the Greens going from 20 to 12%.
All of that, support. Yeah, and you know, Germany digging up coal because they're shutting down their nuclear power stations. The world is upside down and it's starting to fall apart in the EU. That is what the EU election was about in many ways.
All right. Anything more to say about that? Because it does worry a lot of people that there's this sort of relentless march towards sort of game, set, match.
Well, the media isn't going to help either, because you'll see in the media, and especially in Europe, it talks only about far right this, far right that.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever talking about the far left like we have in New Zealand here and how damaging that has been to our country, but the media are one of the biggest problems of the EU.
That's a key point, yeah.
Yeah, 12 years ago today, the UN Special Representative for Migration, Peter Sutherland, gave that speech to the House of Lords and said that the EU should do its best to undermine the homogeneity of its member states. So you know, this is a long-term plan to do that. And this is a guy who belonged to the Bilderberger Group, is a non-executive chairman of Goldman Sachs, or was, International, and a former chairman of oil giant BP. And that's their plan. That they've wanted to turn the tap on, and again, it's the nation destroying effort that Stalin
flood the zone.
Yeah, engaged in. It makes people easier to rule if you destroy the national identity, and people of Europe are kicking back against that.
which I think gives us cause for some hope. I do see that it's almost like there's two paths in front of us, one in which chaos reigns because lots of sporadic kind of pushback parties get into power but don't have the kind of structure and ability to reset. The other alternative, which I hope we end up with, is that the reset happens where you have the pushback parties and politicians take power in Europe and potentially in the US. You know, I don't like Donald Trump as a person. I find him quite just not a nice, I don't know, I just don't like him. But I find myself looking at the US and thinking that he is the better of the two options because of the reset potential.
Well, he can actually speak.
Mm-hmm.
He can walk.
He's not in need of a bed in a local retirement home, which is the alternative. But I do think that we potentially have got hope, but there needs to be a plan for after the agitators take power. Mm. So if France is going to have a real different kind of political scape after their election, if Farage and co. are going to have a spot at the table in the UK, what is their plan once they're there? Because they're saying the things people want to hear. They're saying we're going to take it to the establishment. But once you are the establishment, it's real easy to just...
Yeah, good point.
You know. Yeah. It ties together so many of the strings of things we've been talking about today, though. It's the string of kindness and resting that off for the comrades indies of the world and saying, look, you know, allowing this immigration, what's happened in countries is stranger rape has increased exactly proportionate to that in immigration. So... You know, that's not very kind.
Nothing to see there, Marty. Nothing to see.
Yeah.
It's the problem of cultural relativism. Yeah, I think people are very worried about being seen as racist, but we've got to take a separation of race, of racism and cultural relativism. So on the one hand, we don't like racism because that's a wrong way to discriminate against people. However, I think it is completely right that we can say we live in a liberal democracy where we have established great human rights and we should be proud of our legal system historically. And actually, it is better than the alternative over there. And we don't want, if people are coming to our country, them to bring the culture of crime and, I guess, economic disparity and that kind of thing that exists in those countries. But people see that as a racist statement. I don't. Maybe I'm...
That great bit of trolling where people used to say, Islam's right about women. And liberals' heads explode. But yeah. This gets us back to that Kapa Kingi issue where these are not New Zealand children, they're Maori children. And yeah, that you've got to resist that division by race and get back to values. And I sort of talk about a zipper consensus rather than we get stuck up on all the high-minded stuff. Maybe we just sort of start at the bottom and agree. But the one I always start with, we don't put cigarettes out on kids. Who's all in favour?
Me? Okay, quickly, only got a few minutes left. We've got other subjects, but we're timed out pretty well. But I think we should finish on this one because it kind of makes me laugh in a way. Conservation Minister says saving every species may be too expensive.
Oh, Tama. I'm going to defend him. But first, I will say that he did drop himself in it with how he kind of phrased it. It probably could have been phrased a bit better.
Yeah. Goodbye, Freddie.
Goodbye, Freddie.
Goodbye, Freddie, yeah. He's in the departure lounge.
You could stop dropping 1080. You could do that.
If we honestly look at the government as a whole and all the different problems we have, Potaka's just telling the truth in a kind of too honest way. But if you look at it, like if the Minister of Health was to bluntly say, we have to prioritise which lives we save, which kind of was said in COVID, but that is what Health New Zealand and Pharmac do every day. They make decisions about which medicines they fund, where they put their resources, and because of that, some people live and some people die. And it's a cold calculation. It's a fact of life. But it's calculations that we elect people to make. Same thing with conservation. You know, Tama Pōtaka is tasked with allocating resources, you know, deciding, do we get the most out of our money if we put it here? Do we get, you know, in terms of allocation of the limited resources, is this where New Zealanders care the most, have the most needs? These are the questions that you're having to ask. And there's nothing wrong with it. He just kind of was too honest and blunt in his delivery. And I have to say, I used to work for DOC a few years ago.
Oh,
and
how was that?
Well, I can assure you that if they want to save more species, they can go down to Conservation House on Manor Street and the 600 or so office workers who are in there, and they will find a lot of cost savings in those offices.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I was in the people and engagement unit, which was like comms basically, and there's 60 to 80 of us in there. There's
what
so
you do, Annie? What did you do
at the time?
Day?
I was good question. Well, my background's digital marketing, so at the time I was digital marketing, but I sat there going, how many hooies do we need to have about this? You know, how many layers of bureaucracy are needed to change something on a website?
How many save Freddy social media posts?
Yeah. I mean, I sometimes find myself thinking, and I'm a digital marketer by trade before I got into all the political stuff. I think, do our ministries and whatnot need social media? Is it, what is it for? Why are we using it? And then you'd save, like, entire units wouldn't be there. And people would say that's a bad thing, but I'd say it's saving money and you can save more species.
You know, let's take the Wellington City Council. There are 58 people in the communications department of the council. There are 38 people in the climate change unit.
38? What do they do all day?
It's all related, isn't it? The King Canute-like desire to freeze climate change or freeze the extinction of species. Of all the species that have ever lived on Earth, 99% are extinct.
Yeah, it seems to be the thing that happens. And nature looks after itself pretty well, he said. He said, expecting emails and texts coming in after that.
No, there's nothing wrong with giving it a crack with the resources we have to try and save the ones we can, especially the ones that are dying because of our, you know, the way that we're living on the planet. Great.
There's
okay.
a great line in that book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, and I don't know if you ever remember it from the 1980s, but there's a line there where we're analysed as carbon-based life forms. Well, if you want to go net zero carbon, you really know what that means, don't you?
Yeah, goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Freddie.
It's interesting to ask climate change protesters whether, if they could reduce the level of atmospheric carbon dioxide by 50%, whether they would. And they invariably say yes, but at that point, all plant life or most plant life die.
Yeah,
they don't know. All right, I think we're up against it this Friday morning. That went quick. I want to thank Glenn Inwood for making his first, I guess it's an appearance, really, isn't it?
Thanks, Paul.
On our panel. And thanks again, Marty. Pay attention. Keep up.
Oh, no, great to meet you guys figuratively. Thanks. Great.
Annie, good to have you back too. Thanks so much.
Yeah, lovely to meet you two guys and see you again, Paul.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.